Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
Good morning. How are you going,
Mitch? Good morning, Amelia. How are you?
It's bright and early this morning.
It is bright and early. I'm pretty excited about today.
Oh, we're very excited about today. We've got a very special guest with us all the way from the USA. And I was first introduced to this person many, many years ago when I was a young kid. And it's just, I remember when we met him in 2012, I was so excited for that. I'm really excited for this today. Welcome, Mr. Jack Canfield. How are you this morning? Well, it's evening for you.
I am very, very well. I've never been so well. Being sheltered at home and not having to travel and get on planes and travel across time zones and wake up with the equivalent of 3 a.m. somewhere in India or something. I'm very relaxed. Wow. All good.
That's good.
I have to say, you know, Jack is one of the most renowned and well-known personal development writers and lecturers in the world. And it's very humbling to have you on board again with us and having a quick chat. And we appreciate your time. I have to say, Jack, your hair is definitely after getting very long. You're looking like you're back in the 60s again.
Yeah, I know. I wanted a haircut. My wife says, oh, you look sexy. And I say, no, I'm looking like a hippie. I've got a little ponytail in the back, you know, but we're not allowed to go out and get haircuts yet here in California.
Oh, right.
So yeah. Totally don't trust my wife to do it. So I'm waiting.
We've had some accidents over here.
Let Mitch me just say, had an accident.
I was literally shaving my head. God, I'm doing really well here. And then I've gone around the back and then next of all, this piece of plastic falls in front of me. And I realized I'd run the razor right off the back of my head. It was very funny. And so Jack, it was hilarious. My wife was like,
I thought it was
oh
funny.
Oh my God. Anyway, and we're all amateur hairdressers, I think, at some place in time in our lives. The fact that we started off there, I want to ask the question, when exactly did you get into the field of personal development?
Well, before we go deep into the podcast, can we ask Jack's favourite song?
Oh, your favourite song, Jack.
We always start with a favourite song. Jack, what's your favourite song? And can you hum us a few lines?
My favourite artist of all time is James Taylor. And his song, You've Got a Friend, I think I fell in love with that song when I needed a friend.
Right.
So I used to play that a lot. And I used it in my seminars. I actually have people hold up money and pretend the money's singing that song to them. You know, wherever I am, I'll come running to you. So that they basically attract money into their life through the law of attraction.
So that's, I'll come running to see you again. Is that the one?
Exactly. That's
there
the
you
one.
Go, buddy. There you go.
That's so cool.
That's fantastic. So again, getting back to that, we were speaking to the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Dr. John Gray. And I got off screen with him and I said, John, look, and I just had it in my head. I said, John, I just want to ask the question. You know, you've been around for a while. And I said, well, you know, back then, did you happen to know Buckminster Fuller? And he goes, yeah. I knew Bucky Fuller. He said, yeah. I said, did you happen to know Warner Earhart? And he goes, oh, yeah, we all still meet. All the S guys, we all still meet every week. And I'm like, I just wish I had got that question on air. But back then, who were your influencers? How did you merge into this career? How did you do it?
Well, I took a class my senior year in college. It was called Social Relations 10. It was kind of an encounter group where people sat around and talked about their feelings. I just needed an easy A. I was actually majoring in Chinese history. But I fell in love with human potential and sharing your feelings and talking about goals and all of that. And then I went to Chicago and met a guy in a laundromat who had a car, because I didn't. And there was a lecture series up in Evanston, just a little north of Chicago, called the Living Philosopher Series. And Alan Watts, who was this famous Zen master at the time.
Right.
And there was another guy by the name of Herbert Otto, who was head of the National Center for the Exploration of Human Potential. And he said, we're only using 10% of our potential. So I went up to him after the lecture and said, I want to use the rest of it. What do I do? He said, there's a center here in town, Chicago, where we were, called Oasis, and they put on seminars. I think I went to 17 weekend workshops that year.
Wow.
Ran out of money because I was a graduate student, but I just started volunteering, taking tickets, handing out tissue, you know, whatever needed to be done. And I think the next year I got hired by a man named W. Clement Stone, who was a friend of Napoleon Hill's,
right,
and who wrote Think and Grow Rich. And he introduced me to the whole law of attraction and setting goals and values and all this stuff. And so that's really, that was 1969, something like that, 68, 69.
Right. Wow. And then from there, how long before you were starting to get on stage, lecture? I know. Chicken, you had a couple of books. You had some books before Chicken Soup, right?
Yeah, in 1976, I wrote a book called 100 Ways to Enhance Self-Concept in the Classroom. By then, I had taught for a few years. I was in graduate school again, this time working on a doctorate, which I never finished, but I wrote a book. And when the book took off, I thought, there's a great line in the Cheech and Chong movie where he goes, "We don't need no stinking badges." And so I thought, right.
Badges! We don't need no stinking badges.
Exactly. So I thought, like, I don't need a PhD. So I dropped out of my doctoral program with what they call ABD, all but dissertation. Right. And that book took off and sold 400,000 copies. So I started getting invited to speak to teachers everywhere and teach self-esteem to them, how to teach self-esteem in the classroom. And then we started doing public seminars, and then a recession hit. Teacher money dried up. I started doing corporations and doing that where the money was. And then I realized I was a T with a big T, not small teacher, like school, but teacher at a larger level. That would have been around 1993, something like that.
Wow.
Right. So for me, Jack, I remember, many, many years ago, getting introduced to the book Chicken Soup for the Soul, and I just loved it. Like I felt like there was a time in my life where it was I know when you're young and you just need some of those inspirational things happening, and so getting that book and having Chicken Soup for the Soul was just, for me, it was just something where I think, I don't know how many of them I ended up buying. Right. I think I ended up buying about at least 10 of them, different versions of them. I'm a teacher, so, I bought the one for, the kids, for teachers, and I used to see them everywhere, and I'd love just picking them up and reading a story and getting the inspiration. I just loved that. How did you guys come up with that concept? Can you share about that?
Sure. I learned when I was a high school teacher that the only time the kids really were paying attention was when I was telling a story. Mm. It could have been a historical story about a character in history, or it could have been my own story. But where it really worked was I was teaching in an all-black inner-city high school in Chicago, and right around the time Martin Luther King was killed. So it was a very radical time in American history. And my kids were inner-city, and they weren't really very motivated. They didn't believe in themselves. They had low self-esteem. So I started bringing in stories from Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine, which were the two major magazines for African Americans at the time, about people that have made it in as entrepreneurs, as people that had made it as doctors and lawyers and entertainers. And I would read those stories to them, and I would put them up on the bulletin board in my class. And I would notice they were really interested in that. And so I realized stories really capture people. Mm-hmm. And when I started doing teacher trainings, I would tell stories about students, stories about teachers, stories about things that related to self-esteem. And then at one point around 1992, 91, people started saying to me, "That story about the Girl Scouts, is that in the book anywhere? That story about the puppies, is that in the book anywhere?" And I kept saying, "No, no, no, no." And one day it hit me, like the universe was saying, put these stories in the book. So I was coming back on a flight from LA to, from Boston to LA. It was about a 5-hour flight. And I just wrote down every story I could think of that I knew. There were about 70 of them. And I thought, well, if I write two stories a week, by the end of the year, I'll have a book. And so I did that. And then right toward the end of it, I had about 70 stories. I had breakfast with Mark Victor Hansen, who was my co-author of that series. And he said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "I'm doing these book of stories." And he said, I want to write it with you." And I said, "That's like telling James Michener, the great author, you want to finish his book Hawaii with him after he's written 3/4 of the chapters. How would I let you do that?" And he retorted very quickly. He said, "Well, first of all, half the stories you tell you stole from me. And secondly, you should have 101. And that's a spiritual number, and we should have 101. I'll go get 31 stories. I'm a better marketer than you are, so we'll be a good team." So I went, okay. And that's how we came together, and he did go out and get 30 more stories. I only had stolen about 8 stories from him. I was getting credit. But his MO was so engaging. And he really was a good partner. But that's how the first book came about. And then, fortunately, I'll tell you two more things. At the end of a book, there's often blank pages, you know, because you only have so many pages, and then they print these big things, fold them down, and there's like blank pages. And mostly now you see advertisements in the back. They fill them in. And our publisher said, we've got three blank pages in the back. Do you want to say anything back there? And I said, sure. And literally, I had about a half hour before they were going to press, and I just wrote down, if you have a story, send it in. Maybe we'll do a sequel. Right. And I just gave an address. And we started getting 500 stories a week. And that turned into a second helping of Chicken Soup for the Soul, a third serving, a fourth course, a bowl. And then it started to be Chicken Soup for the Teacher's Soul, Chicken Soup for the Mother's Soul, and so forth. Big question often comes up, too, is how do we come up with a title? Because the title's kind of unique. And Mark and I, we were going to go to New York to try to sell the book to publisher with this agent we had as a friend. We didn't have a title. And so Mark and I said, well, let's just meditate every morning for an hour. We'll ask the universe, God, source energy, however you want to hold that, for a title. And on Wednesday, nothing happened the first 2 days for either of us. And on Wednesday, I'm sitting there, and this big green chalkboard appeared, like in school. And the hand came out and wrote in white chalk, yellow chalk, something like that. It said, Chicken Soup. And I thought to myself, Chicken Soup. And I said to the hand, what the hell does Chicken Soup have to do with this book? And the voice that came back said, when you were sick, your grandmother gave you chicken soup. And that helped fight off the viruses and the colds and stuff. And I said, but this is not a book about sick people. And the voice said, people's spirits are sick. They're living in resignation, hopelessness, and fear. And so I thought, chicken soup for the spirit. And that didn't feel right. Chicken soup for the soul. And I got goosebumps. Mm-hmm. And Mark calls them God bumps. And it's just intuition. Mm-hmm. So then I tell my wife, she gets goosebumps. I call Mark, he gets goosebumps. We tell our agent, he gets goosebumps. We go to New York, we meet with 21 publishers, nobody gets goosebumps. Right. So it's like we got rejected by 21 publishers in 3 days of meetings.
Yeah.
And we had to go to the National Booksellers Association meeting where all the book publishers have their booths because it's a trade show for when the book stores come in to see what books are going to come out in the next season. And we went to, I think, about at least another 100 booths. Like, will you publish our book? Will you publish our book? Will you publish our book? And it wasn't until the third day where this little publisher down in Florida said, we'll look at it. Most people wouldn't even look at it.
Right.
They took it, and a few days later they called us and said, we love it, we'll publish it. I said, did we get an advance? They said, no, we don't do advances. But we'll give you 20 cents of every dollar we make. And that turned into, you know, tens of millions of dollars for us over the years.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. How many of the books did you end up publishing, Jack? Do you know?
Mark and I sold the whole business, the franchise, all our future royalties and everything about 7 years ago. And at that time, with my name on them, there were about 207 books. Wow. And then this other woman took over and started editing the series. So I think there's another 50 since then.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy. Cool. That's crazy. And I remember when we were on, because we obviously hung out on the ship in 2012, and I remember we had a lot of fun. And we were you were telling me some crazy figures about China, because it went bananas in China.
Yeah.
So can you just tell?
Yeah, it did.
Tell
us what happened there. Sure. What happened in China is that the main publishing company is half owned by the state and half owned by private equity.
Right.
Called Anhui Publishing. They were a square mile of printing presses and warehouses. And they also happened to print the textbooks for the schools, for most of the schools in China, of which there are lots of kids in school. And someone had the great idea of using the chicken soup books with Chinese on one page and English on the other to teach English to kids in school. And as a result of that, plus the massive sales just in the general public for reading, I think we sold about 350 million books in China alone.
Wow.
And we're up to about a half a billion sold around the world. Totally. Yeah.
My God.
That's crazy. Isn't
that's
great.
Is that like one in seven people? That'd be one in 10 people in the world, wouldn't it? Am I right? Get my figures right there.
Would own one of those books.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a lot of books.
Yeah. Go on.
I don't know. But like in India, you know, for every book they sell, about six or seven people will read the book. So it's not even counted as a sale.
Yeah.
But that's how many people have read it. Yeah. Passed the book around.
Yeah.
And So it's we have no idea really how many books. And I was in Iran 3 or 4 years ago, and a guy came up to me at lunch and handed me $10,000 in U.S. $100 bills. And I said, what's this for? He said, well, we've been publishing your books in Iran for years. We don't honor international copyright. Wow. He said, but since you're here and I'm here at your workshop, I thought I should give you something. Wow. I said, I'll take it.
Are you serious?
Hundreds of thousands of books in Iran that have never been counted.
Have you got his name? Because I'm going to Iran in about a month. Let me just ask the question. So, I mean, things have changed over time, you know, like there was a time in the 60s and 70s where, you know, the Beatles had gone to India, you know, they'd taken Eastern philosophy, then everybody got an interest in Eastern philosophy. That had come back to the US, back to Europe, and then it became a cliquey thing, you know, Eastern philosophy and started to emerge, and then we started to think about how we were thinking. And, you know, spirituality started to grow and observation of the self. And then, it was always like this mystical stuff, you know, it kind of, you were either into it or you were kind of not, you know, you were either living in your head or you were living in your heart or you were trying to do both. And it seems that mysticism has emerged into a science now. There's a science to, you know, what ancient mystics were saying is now being proven through quantum theory and the understanding of neuroscience, et cetera, and the understanding of the field. You've rode that whole wave and, you know, you're still lecturing and still speaking. How has that influenced your books and how has that influenced what you put out?
Well, first of all, I will answer that, but let me share an anecdote with you. So when John Gray was studying with the Mahesh Yogi, yeah. Maharishi Yogi, yeah. He was one of the, like a personal assistant.
That's right.
And the year that the Maharishi was running a teacher training in Amherst, Massachusetts, in the gymnasium, I was running a growth center, a retreat center in Amherst, Massachusetts, wow. Going to graduate school there.
Wow.
I didn't run into John then, but we were both like at the beginning of our careers, if you will, in the 70s. So we discovered that one day when we were talking at a conference together. So John and I were really, really close friends. I told my wife, if I ever have to spend the rest of my life on a desert island, it's a close toss up between you and John Gray. John is the most interesting person I've ever met in my life. He just velcros every bit of information to his mind. He's so cool. Anyway, to answer your question, I think for me, you're right. Quantum physics, neuroscience, the whole field of mindfulness, which has kind of legitimized it instead of calling it meditation, awareness, and Eastern religion and all that. And the amount of research that's been done, like one of my best friends is a Lama in the Tibetan tradition, actually half Trinidadian, half German, but he meditated for 16 hours a day for 12 years in a monastery in France. And you meditate for 12 hours a day for 12 years, whatever. That's a lot of meditating.
Wow.
And but he also runs all kinds of research at the University of Santa Barbara, where I am, University of California, Santa Barbara. So it's gotten all the academic background and research in terms of the brain waves and all the stuff there. Mm-hmm. So it's become legitimized. And you see it now. You know, everybody does yoga. Nobody talks about that anymore as being anything weird. Mm-hmm. And we see CEOs of corporations meditating every day. I just did a really interesting thing. I wrote a foreword for a book called The Billionaire Secret. A friend of mine named Rafael Bezieg from Poland went around and he interviewed 21 billionaires. It took him about 3 years to get to them all because it's hard to get to billionaires. And one thing he found that all 21 of them, they were from 17 different countries, 17 different industries. Every one of them but two got up before 5:30 in the morning. All 21 of them meditated every day. All 21 of them exercised every day. And most of them read or listened to audiobooks every day for a minimum of an hour.
Right.
So I teach this thing called the Hour of Power, which is 20 minutes of meditation, 20 minutes of exercise, 20 minutes of reading. And all these billionaires, I mean, billionaires leave clues if you look. Mm-hmm. They tell you this is how it's successful. And I know you've interviewed lots of successful people, as I have. And we find that meditation and going deeper, learning to trust your intuition, learning to listen to inner messages, learning to listen to inner guidance is the way to go. It's actually easier. It's flowing with instead of fighting against.
Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to you speak about some of the challenges in your life and the fact that, because I want to talk a little bit about the success principles, because prior to even us going on the cruise in 2012, we read the success principles and we incorporated some of that, and you were talking to us about that on the cruise, and we incorporated some of your concepts and ideas because we had a great party on the ship. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But
when we're off air.
I overheard, I was listening to you speaking, and you mentioned the fact that you'd gotten a bit comfortable with where you were at with chicken soup, and you'd kind of felt like it was just ticking over, and then situations and circumstances happened in your life where you needed to step up. And I wanted you to, and that's where the success principles came from, like you had to step up, and therefore you ended up writing the success principles. One of the things we teach a lot about is that, you know, growth and comfort can't occupy the same space. If you want to grow, you can't be comfortable. If you want to be comfortable, you can't grow. And I want to hear your story, if you can share it, about that and what happened in terms of getting to the point where you were writing the success principles, or and also that you were comfortable with chicken soup.
I will share that, and I'll also share a quote. I was down in the rainforest in Ecuador and with some shamans, and this one shaman said, the people of the North, referring to North America, the problem with the people of the North, they're all addicted to comfort. And so we find that most people in the modern world are in their comfort zone as opposed to their growth zone, and that's why they stay stuck. And so you have to step out into the unknown every time you take a risk, try something new. And so for me, what happened, it was kind of a forced growth, if you will. I went through a divorce, and because of the laws, the way they're set up in California, I would say my net worth at the time was about $13 million of cash. And they also valued my business as worth $13 million. So my wife got all the stocks, bonds, and cash, and I got to keep my job. That's the way I refer to it. And my business wasn't sellable at the time because I was it. And so all of a sudden, here I am without all that extra capital sitting around. And I'm wearing my shirts 3 and 4 days in a row. You know, I'm not going out for dinner. I'm starting to save money again, to have some capital to play with. And I realized I couldn't cruise anymore. I needed to step it up. And what happened was my son and I were in bed one morning. He was like about 11 or 12 maybe. And I was sitting there with my laptop, and he was sitting there with his laptop playing a video game. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, he said, "Dad, how come our house is bigger than everyone else I know's house?" And I said, "Well, we've been more successful." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I live by these principles." And he said, "What principles are those?" And so I started to tell him, and he listened for a while, and then he got bored and went back to his game. But I thought, hey, that's pretty interesting. So I sat there and I just started to type out every principle I knew, you know, set goals, take risks, respond to feedback, have a clear vision, you know, ask for what you want, whatever. And these were all the principles I'd lived my life by. Turned out it was about 113, which was way too many for a book. And so I dropped some out. I was actually thinking of writing a book called The Lost Principles, like the lost things in the Bible, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls or something.
Right.
But I had a bunch of principles I didn't include in the book. But I scaled down to 64 for the first book, and then I edited it, and it took me about a year and a half to write it. I wanted to know that it wasn't just the principles just weren't mine, that they were universal. I needed to know that if I'm going to teach them. So I interviewed 75 of the most successful people I could find, generals in the army and top salespeople and movie stars and Olympic athletes and so forth, and found out, in fact, these principles were universal. And that's when I knew I was onto something. So I wrote the book, and the book didn't take off immediately. Like, you know, you have to go out there and hustle and do a lot of radio and TV. But after a while, people would read it, and then they'd buy a copy for their son. They'd buy one for their sister. They'd buy it for their entire sales team. I had one guy, actually bought over 1,000 copies for all these coaching clients over about a 5-year period.
Wow.
So that's when it really took off. Now it's in 27 languages, millions of copies sold around the world.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I suppose it'd be like choosing between your favorite children, but I want to know what you think are like the top ones, the top success principles that you feel are like, if you don't have them, none of the others will work. Because I know for me, the first one for me is I love the taking responsibility one, because I think if you can take responsibility, then everything else kind of falls into play from there, because you know it's in your hands, you know. Go on.
Everything sits on that foundation. If you don't take 100% responsibility, it's like you're building a building on sand, and so it'll fall over. So, when people ask me what's my favorite or most important success principle, I always say, if you could only keep 5 organs in your body, which ones would you keep? Your brain, your heart, your stomach, whatever. But I think, real fast little, 3-minute course on this would be, you got to take 100% responsibility. No blaming, complaining, and excuse making. I teach E+R=O. There's events in life plus your response equals outcome. So right now we're going through this coronavirus pandemic in the world. At least where I live, we're locked down. We're not allowed to have live seminars. Can't go to gyms. Can't go to restaurants. They're all closed. And so we've had to pivot. That's our response. In other words, most people would blame the coronavirus and say, well, that's why we're not succeeding right now. Because, we had to cancel a lot of live seminars and also speeches and figure out how to do things online. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people just paused. They just kind of went into freeze or fear, and they didn't do much of anything, and they're not doing real well. So it's not the coronavirus. It's our response to it that creates the outcome, whether we make money or not. I just realized as we were doing this that I might not be able to pay my staff come August or September. And I said, I don't want to fire anybody. So what do we do? Well, I looked into network marketing, found a network marketing company that I really love. It does essential oils, which I've become an expert on in the last several months. But we've now enrolled our entire company in that network marketing company. And literally this month, most of my people will make an extra $1,000 or $2,000 from that company, and that's just after 2 months of being involved. So that was a different response than sitting there going, oh, we're going to go bankrupt, mm-hmm. as a lot of people thought. Mm-hmm. So we changed our thinking, we changed our behavior. And so what happens is that your outcomes, how happy you are, your health, your wealth, are all outcomes of how you responded to earlier events. And so you can't blame the event, you can't make complaint about it, you can't make excuses. That takes you out of responsibility. So once people really get that and they start to see that their language is either a language of responsibility, like I'll try, is not responsible, I have to, all those kind of words we use are victim words, they made me, so forth, as opposed to I chose to follow and agree with them. So once we get that 100% responsibility, then you have to get clear, what's my life purpose? I believe everyone has a unique purpose that they're here to live. And if you can identify that, or choose it. Some people choose their purpose based on some experience they've had. But then once that's clear, then what's the vision for how you're going to fulfill that? We clarify our vision, then turn that vision into specific and measurable goals. Most people don't have specific measurable goals. Mm-hmm. Only 10% of kids in North America ever graduate high school having been taught about how to set goals or setting goals. It might be a few college athletes or kids who want to go to college and play in the pros. Couple of the high scoring kids whose dads might be lawyers and teach this kind of stuff or whatever, but most kids don't. And once you have the goals, then you have to believe in yourself. Most people have a lot of limiting beliefs. You know this from your work, mm-hmm. that most beliefs are formed between the ages of 3 and 11. Mm-hmm. Most of them are limiting and they're unconscious. So you got to bring them up into consciousness and then change them and replace them with positive beliefs. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of technology how to do that. We have to take action. We have to overcome our fears. There's tapping, which I love to do. I'm now finding if you tap with essential oils on your fingers, you even get more results. It's like everything's coming together, creating more and more new cool technology. And basically, all action doesn't work. You have to ask for it, respond to feedback. Don't get mad at the feedback. The question that has changed my life, it was with Chicken Soup for the Soul. It's with my wife. It's with everyone I work with. And your viewers and listeners, I encourage you to write this down. It's called On a Scale of 1 to 10, How Would You Rate the Quality of, and then you fill in the blank, our relationship this past week, this seminar, my book, this real estate transaction, this course, me as a dad, me as a manager, me as an employee, whatever. Anything less than a 10 gets a follow-up question called, what would it take to make it a 10? This is where improvement happens. This is where growth happens. This is how relationships and businesses improve. Chicken Soup for the Soul never would have been successful if we hadn't asked 120 people to write, to read every story and give us a number on 1 to 10. 10 gave you goosebumps, made you cry, made you want to call your mother and say, I've got to read you a story. Anything that averaged less than a 9 from 120 people that were urban, suburban, rural, conservative, liberal, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, whatever, didn't get published. Because we knew it wasn't about us, it was about the reader. It's the same thing when you're running a workshop, people listening to your show, you know? So I ask my wife that every Sunday night. I've gotten as low as a 4. that night when I asked what would it take to make it a 10, she said, don't interrupt me when I'm telling a joke because you think you can tell the punchline better. And then she said, I don't care if the NBA basketball playoffs are on. Your job is to put your grandson to bed. My job is to get him up. I don't want to have to remind you. she went on with some other issues in the sink, whatever. And then she said, do you remember what the word foreplay means? I said, yeah. She said, you might want to revisit that.
Okay. Oh, that's so good.
How would I know if I didn't ask her the question, you know? So the last thing I would just say to round this out is perseverance, never give up.
Yep.
So if you respond to the feedback, keep improving, ask people to mentor you and teach you as well. Success leaves clues, Tony Robbins, great quote. Like, you know, go out where the clues are. Listen to shows like yours. Take your seminar. Take my seminar. Mm-hmm. Listen to John Gray, et cetera. And then follow the clues. Mm-hmm. And don't give up until you get there. Mm.
It's funny, you know, you said something there which I think is really, really important. Is because, I mean, a long time ago, the concept of goals, you know, people would set goals and Jack, the difficulty would be that they would set a goal and then attached to that goal was a plus, you know, an infatuation, and simultaneously inside of themselves, they feel as if they're not there. And so as much as they publicly announce their goal, privately, they seem to ridicule themselves and beat themselves up because they haven't actually got there. And it seems that, you know, the concept of reverse engineering is so important because it's a step-by-step thing. You can't write a goal and expect that tomorrow it's going to happen. You, when you reverse engineer it, it seems to eliminate conflict inside of the person because when that happens, they know that no matter what side of the bed they get out of, once you've reverse engineered it, every step you take is about getting to that outcome.
Sure. No, I totally. It's because living your life from the future backwards. So you go out a year or two, what your goal is, and say, well, what would have to happen a month before that? Mm-hmm. When the goal was done, what would have to happen a month before that, and a month before that, and a month before that? Now, sometimes you don't know. And then that's when you go and you read a book or you take a seminar, you watch some TED Talks, you go to see a mentor. I remember I was getting makeup put on for a TV show I was doing in Dallas, like Morning Dallas or something like that. I was promoting the first Success Principles book. And the question I always ask people is, what's your dream? What's your vision? And this makeup artist said, oh, I want to own my own salon someday. And I said, so what's your plan? How are you going to do that? And she said, I don't know. I said, that's a lousy plan. That won't get you there. And she said, well, I don't know what to do. I said, well, I have a radical idea for you. She said, okay, what's that? I said, go find someone who owns a salon and ask them how they did it. You can take them to lunch. You can take them to dinner. You can buy them a drink, whatever it might be. And she went, wow, that's a good idea. No, and to me, it's so obvious. Yeah. Like, you know, if someone's done something, that means someone can do it and they know how they did it. Most people write books about it today. They put franchise manuals together. You know, you want to run a McDonald's? There's someone can tell you how to do that.
Yeah.
They figured it out.
Yeah.
And so the reality is, it's just a matter of being willing to be willing to ask, be willing to put yourself in the position of student and worker. I love that quote. The only place that success comes before work is in the dictionary. You got to do the work.
Yep.
There's inner work and then there's out in the world work. And I think the inner work is equally important, if not more important, because once you get the inner blocks, the fears, the limiting beliefs, the sense of unworthiness, the low self-esteem, the trauma from the past, the decisions you made about not wanting to fail again, not wanting to be laughed at, not wanting to be shamed again, whatever. Once that's released, natural creativity comes forward. You start listening to your intuition. You start noticing things in your environment that can support you. Mm-hmm. Until then, you kind of block.
Mm-hmm. I think,
I think sometimes, it, people are afraid of that stuff. You know, they're afraid if I go for my goals, it's going to bring up, all of this stuff. But nowadays, there's just so many extraordinary techniques to actually help people overcome that and help them to realize that, no matter what happened to you, it was there to enable you and empower you and teach you. Nothing happens to get in the way. Everything that happens is to show you and teach you, to give you and to equip you so that you can. It's like life has your back. Life has got your back. It always has done it. It hasn't brought people down here to torment them, It enables us.
I love that phrase. I'm going to just write it down real quick. Life has got your back. It's so true. The thing is, there was a wonderful book written called What's in the Way is the Way. Mm. I don't know if you've seen that book.
Yeah.
And the idea is the very things that you think are blocking you are the very things you need to address to be liberated.
100%.
And that's where the growth is.
Yeah.
And so I totally agree with that. Do you have the game down where you guys live called Whack-A-Mole, where you go to the arcade and they put in a dollar or some? These little things come out of the hole and you got to hit them with the hammer.
It's not called that, but the kids love it. Where you've got it, where the little alligators come out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my point of view is, as soon as you set a big goal, in your metaphor, the alligators start to show up, and they weren't showing up before. Well, that's comfortable. You don't have to deal with anything. But those alligators are the very things that have been keeping you from having the things you want.
Yeah.
The limiting fears, the beliefs, the trauma, whatever it is, the decisions you made, the limiting. So I think I always tell people, if you want to grow, get married, have children, start a business, and set big goals. Mm-hmm. Everything that's not clear in your life will come up.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
I loved when we were talking on the cruise, or when you were actually saying goodbye or saying your thank yous at the end of the seminar, because we all advocate for doing your inner work, because at the end of the day, if you want to achieve something out here, you've got to start from in here and you've got to do this work. And I remember you saying something, and we've got it on video somewhere right at the end, and you said,
was that where you said Mitch is amazing?
No, it wasn't all about you. you said, people will say to you, you spent how much, you did what, you spent that, how much time did you spend?
Yeah.
And it's about being clear with, often explain it better.
Yeah, you'd stood there and you said, people are going to look at you and say, you did what? You spent how much time? And the truth about it is that we are the news. We are the ones that are changing the world because we're thinking about how we're thinking.
Yes, it's so true. It's so true. We're able to observe our thoughts and we can start to see the ones that are taking us forward to where we want to go and the ones that are keeping us stuck.
Yeah.
And so thinking about thinking is where we should go. All great philosophers, why do we know names like Socrates and Plato and Buddha and Christ and stuff? Because they were aware.
Yeah.
They were awake.
Yeah.
They were aware of their thoughts and they could see that and they could purposely, like the, I forget the name of the group right now, but they could purposely, the Stoics, they could purposely choose their thoughts and begin to see the effect of that and then realize that I am master of my fate. We see in every great culture that those people that become the teachers, the names that are remembered, the historical figures, were the ones who were able to do that. That's why.
Other people, I suppose, would be like questioning them, but they're still like they're staunch in the fact that they get that they, yes, they have spent money, but this is money well worth spending, you know, in order to better myself, in order to look, in order to go within so I know where I'm going, I know where I'm headed. And oftentimes I think people, we don't find it as much now, but I know, remember in the beginning, a lot of people would be questioned about how much money they were spending or how much work they were doing on themselves.
I think there's a revolution in consciousness right now. We're into the dawning of the age of Aquarius, which is the information age. It's a light age. And we're, you know, we're actually very lucky to be alive in a time where it has gone from being kind of poo-pooed and to now being something that is commonplace. You know, people thinking about how they're thinking. And, you know, the concept of thinking about how you're thinking has been around for a long time, but it's a, you know, it comes and goes. Like you mentioned Stoicism there a minute ago, and I'm a big fan of Marcus Aurelius. I think he was just an extraordinary teacher, you know, and philosopher. And, you know, the concepts of being human and being a decent person and thinking about how you think and how that affects the world, you know, has become a major industry, you know, and is making a huge difference in the world. And I have some young kids. Like I got a 4-year-old boy, I got a turning 9 next week year old girl, and then I got a 10-year-old girl. And, you know, in terms of setting goals and teaching the kids how to set goals, what can you inform us with there, Jack? How do you do it?
Well, we used to have them set really small goals, you know, for the week, for the day, you know, set their bed, you know, make their bed by a certain time, whatever. And we used to give them points for doing that.
Right.
Points within rewards. What I found for the young kids was to say, what's something you want? And then let's work out a plan for how you can get it.
Right.
So you're going to have to put in some time. I'm going to have to put in some time or money or, you know, whatever, because they can't drive themselves to the mall and they can't, you know, do things like that. But you can, and you've got the money and so forth. So, or they can earn the money. I mean, I met a kid a couple of years ago. He was 11 years old. He was a millionaire. And it wasn't because his parents were people like us who wanted him to go and do that. They were actually opposed to it. But he was somehow driven to want to make money.
Right.
And so he started getting a couple of chickens, and he started selling the eggs to the neighbors. And when he got enough egg money, he bought a lawnmower, and then he started doing lawns.
Right.
And we got enough money from that, he bought another lawnmower and hired other kids to do lawns and paid them half of what he charged the people.
Right.
And then he bought a power hose or a power washer. And then he started taking that money and buying real estate with it. By the age of 11, he started when he was 6. By the age of 11, he had $1 million worth of real estate.
Wow.
So some kids have that inner drive. For my kids, it wasn't so much, because we were fairly wealthy by the time my kids were, you know, growing up. And so they kind of took it for granted. However, when my stepson came to me and said, I want to learn to fly a plane, he was 16, said, I want to learn to fly a plane. I said, well, go find out what it costs. And it was like $2,000 to learn to fly a plane. So I said, you go earn the first $1,000, I'll give you the second $1,000.
Right.
So he went and got a job selling newspapers phone bank, you know, where they call up people and you want to subscribe to the LA Times.
Right.
And within 3 months, he earned $1,000. He actually had his pilot's license before his driver's license.
Wow.
So it was always called, like, you know, I'm not just going to give you something. You've got to at least put in some sweat equity. And then as my kids got older too, I would also pay them to read a book. And if you read this book, I'll give you $10.
Right.
Because I knew that was better than giving them $10 to wash the car. I can get someone to wash my car, and I hope they grow up and get someone to wash their car too.
Right.
But the reality is, if they grow up and they know how to set a goal, they listen to, you know, Byron Katie or John Gray or, you know, whoever it might be, John Assaraf or whoever. But the point being, that to me was more important. And then when they were really old, in their late teenagers, I used to have Saturday morning classes for an hour. And I would teach them stuff out of the success principles. They hated it. The reality was now they talk about how grateful they are that they did it.
Yeah.
One of my stepson, who's 28, graduated not the top, but the top 10th of his class at a major business school in America, the Wharton Business School. Got a job with a hedge fund. Is doing about $263,000 a year at the age of 28. And, you know, my other son took a little longer to get there. He's more artistic, but he's coming out of the Berklee College of Music right now and pursuing a singing career.
Wow.
But they're really going for their dreams, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just can I go on the topic of money quickly? One of the principles is paying yourself first, and this is one of the things we teach for sure. Can you explain that and why you put that there as a success principle?
Yeah, because most people don't invest properly. In other words, they spend money on things that they think they need, like a new car, a wider television screen, a bigger stereo, you know, a vacation in Las Vegas or whatever. But, you know, as Robert Kiyosaki talks about, you need to build assets. You need to invest in yourself in terms of taking seminar, any investment yourself, whether it's an asset you're buying, it's going to accrue over time, like land or stocks or, you know, your portfolio, or investing in yourself in terms of your own personal development. You know, like I've spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on seminars and retreats and coaching programs and so forth, but I've made millions because of it. Yeah. You know, yeah. There was people often say, well, you know, that's a lot of money to spend, like the cruise we were on. People spent, I don't know, $1,000, well, probably over $10,000 to go on a cruise.
Yeah.
We just did a cruise recently. It was like, you know, $6,000 to $7,000 a person. They didn't have to fly from Australia and New Zealand to get there. And so, and unfortunately, I don't think any of us will be doing cruises for a while. But nevertheless, what happened is, you know, if I told you, people say, well, I don't know if I can afford that. I say, well, if I had a brand new Mercedes-Benz worth $70,000 outside, would you give me $3,000 for it? Yeah. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it's worth so much more. Well, then obviously I haven't convinced you yet of how valuable this is for your personal development. Because if I could double your income in 1 year, what's that worth to you? If you're making $50,000, now you're making $100,000. You just earned $50,000 more. Is that worth $2,000? Is that worth an investment?
Well,
what if I could invest, you know, $3,000 now and have my income triple in 5 years? That's worth it. Most people don't do that. They stay stuck and they wonder why.
Do you think part of it is, you know, there's the concept, you know, I think was Joe Dispenza on the same, on the same cruise. I think Joe was on just before you had come on, but that whole concept of one of the reasons that people don't invest like that is because they haven't turned up there, and if they turned up there, then they could go back in time. But we don't have time machines; they'd heavily invest, you know. And I think that one of the keys now is saying to people or teaching people that, you know, whatever your goal and dream is, you have to already feel as if you're there, and let, you know, life is only delivering circumstances that give you what you that are giving you what you feel. And it seems like when you turn up there before you arrive and wait there until you turn up, then life tends to fall into place for you and bring everything into your life that you need to get there. But, you know, now we're able to show people, and you're not having to convince them anymore, because science says that, you know, we're a broadcasting system where we're mingling with the atmosphere, and it's bringing about what we want. And so when you're dealing with people, how do you overcome that? Do you think it's your credibility and the fact that you've been in this industry for so long and achieved so many goals, or is there an actual formula so that you don't have to convince people anymore, so that people are actually able to see that a goal is something that is really achievable?
I think what I've done is try to show people that there are people like them. Whether they're black or white, whether they grew up in the ghetto, whether they have one leg or two. You know, you got Nick Vujicic out there who's walking around with no arms and legs, who's doing a great job. You know, so but the point being that you're going, like, if that person can do it, you can do it. And so with Chicken Soup for the Soul, we were constantly putting stories in front of people of what I call ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And so if I can see someone like me, we did it. Big mistake I made in the first book, by the way, the first edition of The Success Principles, was all these famous people I interviewed, I put them as the examples, thinking people would go, oh, if it made Steve Jobs successful, it'll make me successful. If it made John Gray successful, they didn't respond that way. They thought, oh, they have a different DNA than I do. So in the second book, when I did the revision of it, the 10-year anniversary, almost all the stories are people who read the first book who were normal people. Plumbers and teachers and, you know, people that grew up poor in the South or whatever. And they were like, oh, if he can do it, I can do it. You know, if that guy who was an alcoholic or a drug addict could get off that and be successful like me, that's who I am, then I can do that as well. You know, so I think that's really been the majority of it for me. And I like, you know, Joe Dispenza is, I love him. In fact, he lives in the same town I do, Santa Barbara now. But the point being, he talks about the quantum field and how in the quantum field, something can happen like that. You know, you read about people who have a near-death experience. They have cancer. They're dying. They got tumors all over their body. They go through the tunnel. They meet a being of light. They make a decision. They see how their cancer was like serving them in some way that don't need to anymore. They come back, and within 1 week, all the cancer cells are gone. And like, you know, that's like a It's like a miracle.
Yeah.
But those miracles exist all the time if we can choose to believe it mm-hmm. and come from that space, choose to live into it, to mm-hmm. be what you're saying, live in the feeling of it. You know, yeah. That's why everyone that teaches goal setting and knows what they're doing, and you do as well, is you've got to visualize what it would look like, feel what it would feel like, and hear the sounds you'd already hear if you were there, mm-hmm. and then act as if you're already there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I act as if I'm already living my future goals all the time.
Right.
You know, my wife says, how can you afford to tip that person $100? I said, well, my goal is to be worth $100 million. Do you think we'd do it then? Yeah. Yes. Well, let's do it now. That's it could come faster, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is why we had the party on the cruise ship that we had, because based on what you had written about and talked about as showing up, you know, in 5 years' time. So we got everybody to dress up. You weren't there. You happened not to be there at the time. You'd already left. But everybody dressed up as they were going to be in 5 years' time.
Yeah.
And the whole conversation, so I think the party lasted a couple of hours, and every single conversation you had as that person.
Yeah.
And it was actually beautiful to watch in the moment, because you started to see people come alive and start mm-hmm. to act differently, be different, like, you know, create from a different space, you know, mm-hmm. speak from a different perspective. And then when we looked at people's, you know, 5 years later, a huge portion of the people had achieved
smashed
everything that they'd set out, even though everything that they, I remember one woman, how she turned up, but everything she turned up as that day was literally nothing like she was in that moment. But I think she'd projected it so much that she didn't realize how it was coming about. It was
funny. One of the women turned up at like bags of money, just bags and bags and bags of cash. And it was like, it was great to watch, but and then watching them over time achieve that goal was just incredible. You know, very, very humbling. Yeah.
Really cool. And
you're talking about what I call come as you'll be party. And when I do my seminars, it's the hardest thing to get people to stop. That's the only problem with them. Nobody wants to stop doing it.
Yeah.
We usually do it right before dinner over cocktails, and then nobody wants to go in and eat dinner because they're having so much fun living out their dreams in 5 years in the future. And I totally get it.
Yeah, that was 8 years ago, can you believe,
wow.
when we
wow.
met? And just a quick little success story for you as well, Jack. One of our girls who's here with us today, she was driving, she doesn't drive, she got an Uber here this morning, and her Uber driver, she told the Uber driver that this is where she was coming to be with us as we interviewed you this morning, and he said success principles just totally changed my life. Mm. And he was explaining to her how he listened to your success principles. I think it was after a divorce.
That's right.
And as a result of that, his life has just changed.
And she said the whole taxi drive was just him talking about the success principles.
So there you go.
You know, I was in Chicago. I was running a workshop and it started to snow, and it was the end of the day and I was done with the client, and I was running out to get into a limousine to take me to O'Hare Airport that the client had arranged for me. And it was really snowing hard, and I was afraid I might not make the plane or they might shut down the airport. So I was really in a hurry. I jump in the back of the car. We take off, and I ask the guy, you know, how do you think we'll get there on time? And he answers with an accent. I said, where are you from? He said, Lithuania. And I said, what brought you to Chicago? He said, well, I saw this movie called The Secret, and there was this guy named Jack Canfield in it, and he said you had to make a vision board. And so I made a vision board and I put it above my dresser with the city of Chicago. And so I watched that and looked at that every day for a couple of years and visualized myself in Chicago. And I just got here last year. I said, do you know who I am? He said, no, I just knew I had to pick up a client. I said, I'm Jack Canfield. He almost swerved off the road, you know, but I hear those stories all the time. It's so,
so cool.
Fun, you know,
it's
so
magic.
It's so cool. I'd like to share what you're, because you're working on you've just released a workbook for the Success Principles, yes?
Yeah, I'll hold it up so people can see it. It's called the Success Principles Workbook.
Yep.
Cool.
Got 17 principles in it.
Wow.
And what I did was, because the first book is, it's a big book. It's got 64 principles. The new edition is 67, because we added things like in success in online social media, stuff like that. But what happens is that I took the 17 core most important principles and put them in the covers of a book. So literally you work your way through the book, and we tested it with about 25 people who'd never heard of me, never read the Success Principles. And we asked them, just do the book. And at the end of that a couple of months that took him to do it, because there's 17 lessons, if you will, and we'd say take 3 or 4 days to do each one. People had doubled their income. Wow. People had left bad jobs. People had lost 20 pounds. People, you know, it was amazing. And so it was like, I wanted to see if we could achieve the same thing we achieve in our coaching program that we achieve through a book. And that's why we did it. Because I was noticing, and I'm sure you noticed it too, you've written books and so forth, and people read the book. A lot of people get it. Some people don't. Mm-hmm. But the people who go through your seminars, they change.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to be able to put that workshop experience between the covers. And I had no idea that it would come out right when the COVID, you know, COVID-19 thing was happening. So all of a sudden people have the time. We sold out of the book in the first 2 days on Amazon.com. They went back to print 10,000 more the next day.
Wow.
We're printing, they're doing, I said they're selling like 350 a day on Amazon, something like that.
Wow.
So we know it's working. People love it. And it's, you talked about what are the core principles, what are the most important ones. That's the ones that are in that book.
So I was really just going to say.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, I've read The Aladdin Factor. I've also read The Success Principles, and obviously I don't think I've read every Chicken Soup. I don't think that's possible, but no. I've read a few of them. And The Success Principles is just awesome. So I recommend that to anybody. And I haven't got the workbook yet, but I'm absolutely going to get that because
I'm sure you're going to send us a copy, Jack. I'm sure you're going to send us a copy.
Sales Principles Workbook. Yes.
I tell people, spend 1 year to read this book. Read one chapter a week.
Yeah.
And by the end of the year, you'll be 99% of the way through the book. But don't just read it, do it.
Yeah.
I almost called the workbook, don't read this book, do this book.
Right.
But I decided not.
I think that's so important because I think it's the experience that shifts people. It's not just the, you know, reading. People listening to something or reading something isn't going to make a difference. They have to be doing stuff. Yeah. They have to be taking action. So I think that's great advice, you know. Before we finish up, Jack, I want to know a few things. But firstly, what was your favourite part of being on the ship back in 2012 when we were on the ship together? We had such a good time.
I think my favourite part of the ship, well, there were two things that were favorite about it. One was the ship itself. That was an amazing ship.
Yeah. Wasn't it?
And because I was on that ship, I literally took a cruise with my team last year on the same cruise line because there are nightclubs and plays that go on and six orchestras and all that. I would say the second thing was the captain's dinners where we had private dinner, about 15 people and the speakers and the chef was amazing. It was a Dave Ramsey trained chef, as I remember.
Yeah.
And the food was extraordinary. The wine pairings were amazing. And the conversation was great because you could really settle in with people. And the cocktail parties and the wine tastings and that. And then I just think just the fun. It's those cruises. I'm really sad that, like, I don't think anyone's going to take a cruise for a while because of the whole virus thing and how many people got sick on the cruise line. Because the one we just did a year ago was on their newest ship called Symphony of the Seas. And every night we were in a jazz club, a comedy club, a dance disco. You know, it's like you have fun at night and work all day. And you just like, that's the way we should all live our life.
Yeah, I think, and that was one of the things for me, you know, coming up with the idea of doing that was helping people just to be alongside people like you, Jack, and Dispenza and Di Martini and us, and just all coming together and just having a good time, relaxing, sharing information and realizing that we're all the same. We're all in the same boat going in the same direction technically, right?
It demystified and humanized everybody. You know, and we had a lot of fun. I remember, especially at those meals, we had a lot of fun. And afterwards, it was just great.
Great fun.
Absolutely loved it.
Yeah,
people don't have enough fun anymore. I think fun is required.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had a teacher. She was 81 years old. She handed out these T-shirts that said IIFAI, something like that. I said, "What's that stand for?" She said, "If it ain't fun, F it." You know. So and she didn't say that, but, other words. And that was her whole philosophy of life. And she was a very effective teacher up all the way until she died in her late 80s.
Yeah. Out of everything in your life, or even right now, Jack, what are you the most grateful for? What do you have gratitude
I'm
for?
I'm grateful. I have gratitude for my wife, who could be on Saturday Night Live. She is just one of the funniest people on the planet. Makes me laugh every morning. I mean, woke up this morning 3 or 4 times before breakfast where I was howling. And she is a social animal, so she can make sure we spend time with friends and go on vacations. Right. 3 years ago, she came to me and said, "We're taking a month off every year from now on." I said, "You don't understand my business." She said, "You don't understand my life." And I said, "Okay." And so we spent a week in Hawaii, the next year a week in Hawaii, a month in Hawaii, and then this year we spent the month of February in India, in Mumbai, at a Ayurvedic clinic, doing longevity and detoxing and all this kind of stuff. That was pretty amazing, and got me in good shape to deal with the coronavirus. My immune system's as good as it's ever been.
Yeah, we got back from, we were in India in February as well, Jack. Yeah. We got back literally just in time.
Yeah.
And we're really grateful we got it in. India's an amazing place, isn't it?
We had 40 clients out there with us, and everybody, I think you got back like literally.
I literally got back within 12 hours of everything being locked down. Yeah.
But you seem to do quite a bit of that stuff. Like you said, you know, you've spent some time with shamans and that sort of thing, which is something that I have a huge interest in that understanding of mysticism and has that been something you've always done?
Not really. I've always been interested in meditation and spiritual teachers, but the shaman thing happened about 5 years ago. I went to the rainforest with a woman named Lynn Twist, who runs something called the Pachamama Alliance, and we went and lived in with the Achuar, which is a native group in the middle of the rainforest. We did ayahuasca, which is a plant medicine, which was very powerful, transformational experience. Last year, I took a group down to Costa Rica to a place called Rhythmia, which is we did 4 nights of ayahuasca plant medicine with 4 different shamans.
Right,
that was quite transformational. I was hoping to take another group this November. We've scheduled it. We'll see if we're allowed to travel then. Right. There's this fear of a second wave of coronavirus coming around, but we'll see. But I intend to do that as an annual event now for some of my advanced students.
Right.
Have you got a few more minutes? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
About your experience with that, Jack?
No problem.
Just share like what your experience is and why.
I look, I'll give you an example. My experience of it, like when you say 4 days of ayahuasca, I did 1 day of ayahuasca and I thought my insides were going to come out. But the insights that I had were, you know, because we'd done all the proper prep work. I had the shaman that we worked with played like, I don't know, 20 instruments, sang to us through the whole process. It was absolutely beautiful. And the insights I had were astounding. But I couldn't do 4 days of it. I think, oh my God.
It's not 4 days, it's 4 nights. So what happens is you go, it's a week-long program. The first 2 days are all preparation. You go through a medical exam, get your heart checked, make sure your blood pressure's okay. They have a doctor on staff there. And so it's all very safe. They have EMTs ready to go in case someone needs to go to the hospital. They've never had to use them in the 5 years they've been operating. But what you do, there's a lot of breath work and yoga and meditation during the day and in the morning. It's a totally, organic, mostly vegetarian diet, although they do have fish available if people want it. I didn't. Been doing a plant-based diet recently. But anyway, then at night, you show up around 7:30, the shaman talks for about an hour, and then you ingest the ayahuasca. And as you know, usually you throw up or you have diarrhea. Because it's a toxic substance if you leave it in your body too long or if you take too much, your body knows what to do. It gets rid of what it doesn't need. And then the plant medicine takes over. And I had the most amazing awarenesses. At Arrhythmia, which I love that place, they have 3 intentions you work with. It's show me who I've become, which is like show me where I've become an idiot in a sense. You know, show me where I'm selfish, I'm locked down, I'm afraid, I'm scared, I'm controlling, whatever. The second one is connect me back with my soul, reconnect me with my soul. And the third one is heal my broken heart. Mm-hmm. And so the first night, I got to see all these places where my wounds as a child, where I couldn't cry, where I wasn't allowed to ask for things, where I got punished for things, et cetera, and how I shut down myself, shut down my emotions, shut down my willingness to. I think the reason I wrote The Aladdin Factor is I needed to teach myself it was okay to ask. And what I didn't realize is how much more there was still to do with that. And then the third night, I remember it was heal me back with my, reconnect me with my soul. And I remember all through my life, I had been afraid to surrender to any one teacher or any one religion. Because I was always afraid, like, if I surrendered, they'd say, well, you got to wear orange robes and shave your head and chant Hare Krishna at some university or something. I thought, I'll do that. And so I was afraid of, like, you know, being out of control. And so I said that to my soul. And my soul said, I'm not going to ask you to do anything you don't want to do for a year. And because I was really afraid it was going to make me sell my house or something, you know, and give up all wealth.
Yeah.
So I have very few attachments, but my house is one of them. And so anyway, my soul says, okay, great. And then all of a sudden, like literally this wave of energy went through me. It was like someone was washing me out. And then I was reconnected with my soul. And I was having this conversation with this part of me that I thought I was in touch with before, but not the same level. And then we were kind of sending texts back and forth to each other. I'm seeing these texts on the phone. My soul would say something and I'd respond. You know, it was really cool. And then it said, now go ahead and sell your house. And I said, wait a second, we had a deal. And then it said, just kidding. You know? And this humorous relationship started to develop. Wow. And the last night, I had this thing where I never cried, and I really needed to do that. And when the tears started to come up, because I didn't, my mother died, I didn't cry, my divorce, I didn't cry, all these things where I should have cried. And it was like Thor and you know, Rocket Man were kind of like, you know, one of these movies where they're kind of throwing energy at each other and exploding. And finally, I threw up. And I cried and I cried and I cried. And my wife was there. She was like five beds away. And she just said, oh my God, she was so happy to hear it. And then that night I went up for a third cup, which is highly unusual, but I felt like I should. Because I really felt like I could do, I just knew something else was supposed to happen. So I went up to the shaman and I was kind of like, you know, walking like, ooh, are you still there?
Yep.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah,
I hit something on my screen. And so I walked up and I looked at him and I said, I think I need a third cup. And he looks at me kind of like a doctor looks at someone. Could I really give him more penicillin? I don't know if he can handle it, you know. So finally he agreed. And I went back and sat on my mattress. And all of a sudden, I kind of fell asleep for a little bit. I woke up. No. What first happened was, I saw this image of Christ, and I grew up Christian, but I don't consider myself only a Christian. I consider myself ecumenical, world religion, all that, and more spiritual. But I saw Jesus on a cross kind of just floating toward me in this beautiful gold sculpture, like a Pope might wear or something. And then he got off the cross, and walking right toward my third eye. And it was like fans blowing in the movies, like, you know, all the robes were blowing in wind behind him. Walked right into my third eye. I had an explosion of light, like they talked about, like Shaktipat when you receive it from a guru in India. And then I fell asleep. And when I woke up, the world was different. Everything was like Christ-like. Everything was like energy. Everything was God. And I remember walking outside, and my wife was outside talking to some people, and they all went, oh, my God, what happened to you? And I literally was like, I was somewhere else. I was in another space. And I've been living my life from a space of love. I gave a speech a week after I came back from Bidney after that. And I walked out on stage to 1,000 people and I said, the reason I'm here is because I love you. And I know that's going to be hard to hear at first and you'll think I'm some kind of weirdo. But really, I could be retired. I've got plenty of money. But I want to bring to you what the gifts that I've had. And my talk was totally different. Mm. I taught all the same stuff about it. But it was in a context of love. And the promoter came up at the end of it was a 3-day conference with half the people, you know, all their names. And she said, that was the best session of all. She said, you were so in your heart. You were so present. And so I can't say I'm totally there where I was a week afterwards. You know, it's always like 5 steps forward, 2 steps back, but I'm different. And, And I can't wait to go back and do it again.
Yeah. Mm. Yep.
That's cool. I've not had anybody say that they've had a playful experience like that, because that was my experience. It was like we were having a joke together. It was like
it was playing with
me, you know, and I'm like, come on, like, you know, and it was kind of like this banter between us. It was cool. And I haven't heard anybody say that. So it was cool to hear you say that, you know? Yeah.
So Jack.
Yeah, one other thing I would. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, they told us when we were down at Rhythmia, you're going to have one of four experiences. One's called Nada, which is Spanish for nothing. Some people, they don't get many visions or anything. Some of you will get a lot of visions. Some of you will be taught, like the plant medicine teaches you, like a teacher. It just, you, all of a sudden you're getting instructions, you know. And then they said you can also get healings. And so, but you have to ask. So I ruptured a disc in my spine a number of years ago in the yoga class. I just torqued my body too far and it ruptured my spine. I had an option of surgery or not. I chose not to do the surgery. So I still had some residual pain. And I said to the ayahuasca, to the plant medicine, the mother ayahuasca, they call her. And I said, if you're willing to give me a healing, I would love a healing for my back. And the medicine said, I'll give you a new spine if you'll use it. And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, you don't always stand up for the things you need to stand up for.
Wow.
But if you'll promise you'll start taking a stand for the things you need to take a stand for, I'll give you a new spine, but you have to use it. And I said, okay, deal. And I had been much more confrontive, much more clear about my boundaries, much more clear about saying no or asking for what I want or confronting things I think are unjust or unfair than I ever was. I think I was a little bit afraid of authority before. Like I'd go so far. Don't piss off Hitler. You know, he's got an army kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't quite feel that the same way anymore.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. Oh, I think we could talk for another 2 hours, but I think we might need to leave you there because I know it's getting later for you there, Jack. We really appreciate your time. I was going to mention, like, you forwarded our book. I don't know how you've written so many books because we're still getting around to writing the first one and getting that out there, but it's a process and it's exciting.
And we're close. We really appreciate the forward that you did for us. That was magic.
Awesome.
But, Jack Canfield,
you're very welcome.
We deeply, deeply appreciate your time.
We love talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. And that was awesome. Thank you.
Can I just say to your viewers, if you're interested in my work, go to jackcanfield.com.
Absolutely.
Find out more.
Yep. Jackcanfield.com. Okay, get the success principles and get the success principles workbook because they're awesome. Yeah. Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you found this information inspiring, make sure you subscribe and tune in to the next Dorothy and the Dealer podcast.